Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
That was the tricky part. Right?
Yeah, I'll just have to do. Excited for Indy?
I'm most excited for the band tomorrow.
Oh yeah.
It's been an exhausting week for me.
It's nice. Like sleeping.
Been so busy lately. I don't remember the last time I actually slept in.
That's torture.
I know. I have to get up early for all the court stuff and everything else.
The one thing I'm happy with in grad school is like classes, and none of my classes are more than 12. I understand the grad school students need their sleep.
Right? Seriously.
Like, I think there's only like one or two classes offered in the morning, actually.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Erica? Yes, this is Erica and Jason.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, hold on a minute. There's a little problem that I'm actually on a ferry right now. I'm doing a residency program, and I guess I screwed up the schedule, so it's gonna be really loud for like 6 minutes.
Okay.
But if you can hear me okay, I mean, I'm trying to find a, I guess a ferry is not like the quietest place to be. Hold on a
Yeah, I
second.
mean, we can kind of hear you, but I don't know if it's going to be good enough audio to be
I'm
excellent.
searching for, oh wait, I think I found maybe a quiet place. I'm on the ferry to Governor's Island right now. I'm doing an artist residency. Oh wait. Is this good? I sound quiet.
Yeah, it actually sounds fine now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I found a little alcove. Hello.
Hi. How this works is I read an introduction and then Jason asks the question. This doesn't go out live or anything. We record the audio and then we podcast it later, and of course we'll let you know when it's live. And it usually takes, 20, 30 minutes, depending upon how much you have to say. So if you're ready, we can go ahead and get started.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, great.
You might just have to talk a little louder until, like,
Okay.
sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Hello, I'm Erica McIntyre, Jason Connections Content Director. Today, our founder, Jason Harris, will be speaking with to Amy Ostricker, a PTSD peer-to-peer specialist, artist, author, and writer, for the Huffington Post, health advocate, actress, and playwright.
Thank you so much for joining us today. You tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, well, thanks for having me. Well, I have a pretty complicated story. So I'm an artist and actress and all those things, but I grew up just a happy-go-lucky kind of musical theater ham, and I was pretty determined that that was what I wanted to do with my life. And I was that kind of teenager that applied to 17 colleges and pretty much was planning on studying musical theater and going to Broadway and, conquering the world. So I had a boy teacher who I really admired when I was 15. and he really became my mentor. And then, you know, 2 years later, when I was 17, he all of a sudden started molesting me. And I was so shocked that I just froze. You know, I completely left my body, and I don't even remember anything that happened. I just remember, you know, I had always been very in touch with myself, you know, a very intuitive person and spiritual, and I used to love these nature walks, and all of a sudden, I couldn't really focus on the trees anymore. I could only focus on the sound of, like, my feet moving. You know, everything became very mechanical, to the point where I didn't even recognize myself anymore. And so I just went to the bookstore one day just because I felt like something was wrong, and I wanted to, you know, get, like, a spirituality book or something. And I happened to pick up, you know, The Courage to Heal, and just because I liked the title. And I saw that it said, for survivors of sexual abuse. And that caption was so kind of out of my realm that I almost laughed and put it back. But I ended up taking it out again, and as I flipped open the pages of symptoms and I looked down the list, you know, I feel numb, I feel out of body, there's something wrong with me. It was really a revelation for me that, oh my God, you know, I was sexually abused by my voice teacher. And then from then it really felt like I was carrying this really anxious, you know, very dark secret that I had no idea what to do with. And I kept that secret inside for months, and I really felt it. And then until, you know, April of my senior year, when I turned 18, I finally told my mom, just because I couldn't take it anymore. And, you know, we were going to get therapy and all those things. And then 2 weeks later, I just had a really bad stomach ache that wouldn't go away. And, you know, I went to the ER because my dad thought we should just get an x-ray. And my cheeks actually perforated on the way there. There was so much pressure. And I guess the fluid was about to go to all my internal organs, and I went septic. And the surgeon cut me open, and my stomach literally hit the ceiling of the operating room. And both my lungs collapsed, and I went into cardiac arrest, and I was in a coma for months. And this was from someone who was perfectly healthy, you know, her entire life. So I woke up from a coma months later, obviously wondering what the hell happened. You know, I had never been sick before, and I was trying to figure out why I wasn't talking about college. You know, I had just gotten my college acceptance letters before I got sick. And so it was definitely strange waking up in a completely new reality. But rather than kind of being totally devastated, it was almost a sense of, like, wonder. Like, I was kind of rediscovering the world again. So I sort of have interesting memories of coming out of a coma, but then I was sort of hit with reality once I was alert enough, where the doctors told me that I didn't have a stomach anymore and I couldn't eat or drink. And they didn't know if I'd ever be able to again. So this was, you know, completely unexpected. And so I guess what helped me survive is that I didn't really know how to act like a patient. And I think my biggest fear was that I wouldn't make a mark on the world anymore, you know, because I had always identified as a performer. That was always my way of connecting. And I think my biggest fear was, oh, my God, you know, I won't be relevant anymore. So I think that kind of filled me with, like, a manic drive to just keep going and making up. Oh, sorry, are you saying something?
No, I'm just going,
Oh, yeah, well, there's a lot of, but, you know, I think, you know, even making up hope when it wasn't there, it helps that I have, like, an amazing family. But really just creativity and connecting with, you know, my passion really got me through. That being said, it's one thing not eating and drinking when you're in the hospital, but when I was finally discharged months later, because I wasn't really healthy, but I wasn't really sick, That was the worst because, you know, imagine being home, like, in the real world, like, not even being able to have an ice cube, and doctors are telling you that they don't know if that will ever happen again. So I really had to kind of cultivate, you know, hope and take it day by day. And I think I did more in those 6 years than I have in my entire life. You know, I started a chocolate business because I was so hungry that I just wanted to play with food. You know, I started in musicals. I taught myself how to dance again. And eventually everything, you know, I got back. And it turned into 6 for the past 10 years and 27 surgeries before I could even, you know, have water again. So you know, staying in touch with performing really helped me. But so the reason why I ended up calling this kind of a beautiful detour is because of all these obstacles. You know, I was exposed to things and I met people and I learned things about myself that I never would have ordinarily. I think the biggest example is that I'm a visual artist now. I was never a visual artist. I actually discovered art by accident, 13 surgeries in. This was supposed to be my final reconstructive surgery that was supposed to connect all my intestines and, you know, have me eating and drinking and healthy again. But it was a total disaster. Basically, I flew to California to celebrate, and I got air vaxxed back to Yale Medical Hospital because my wound just exploded. So this was a complete setback, and worse, it was just a really terrible disappointment. So I was stuck at Yale Hospital for months, really just pissed off and losing faith in everything. And my mom actually started bringing cheap art supplies to the hospital. And I resisted it for a long time because I was just upset. But I remember one day I had just reached my lowest point, and I didn't even know how to, you know, like, make up hope anymore. And I remember, like, taking one of those canvases, which I had never used anything like before, and thinking to myself, like, I have no idea what the heck I'm doing, but, like, I am feeling a lot right now, and I need to do something where I don't have to use words. And I just remember painting that first picture. And it was such kind of a physical experience where I was just kind of feeling everything. And I realized that painting was a way to express what was too, you know, complicated and overwhelming for words. And it was a way that I could kind of be with that fear and sadness and all of those uncomfortable emotions, but in a safe way that didn't kind of, you know, overwhelm me. So after that, you know, I really took to it, and I was stuck in that hospital for months, and within like 2 months, I made 70 mixed media paintings. I was discharged, and I put up my huge, you know, my first huge art show, and really found a new identity from that. And I mean, listen, there are tons of twists and turns that have happened, you know, up until this point, but I think what I've learned is that I can't even, like, ask myself what my life would have been like if this had never happened. And that's how I ended up kind of coining the word, like, a detourist, that mm-hmm. every twist and turn, like, every detour has made me really who I am. And what I call, like, a detourist is someone that, you know, there's something in life that they don't expect. And, you know, they don't expect much. All they do is they're present and they're open to the past. You know, they might not even be ready to take one, you know, step in front of the other, but just being open that, you know, this could possibly lead to new opportunities, even if it hasn't happened yet. And it's so easy to say and sound inspirational, but it's hard as hell to trust something when you have everything planned out and you don't have an outcome. You know, I go through that, you know, day after day, because I think, you know, we have one detour and then another one comes and comes and keeps going. But, you know, with hindsight, at least the detours that have happened so far, I ended up writing a one-woman show about my life, which I've been touring for 5 years, Gutless and Grateful. I mean, that's just one example of that script was made of all of the journal entries I had written when I couldn't eat or drink. You know, that was how I coped. I would actually lock myself in my room and just journal. Just to pass the day for 16 hours a day, just typing and typing. And, you know, because of the art, I landed on the Today Show, and once, you know, I met a composer on the Today Show, that was really how the show came to be. And then I premiered Gutless and Grateful in 2012 in New York, which is a huge deal because I had never even talked about what had happened to me before. You know, it was all over the news, but, you know, I never said it from my voice. So I'm thinking that I did a pretty shameless thing, or fearless, that, like, I told it for the first time, not just, like, to friends, but I invited New York theater critics, total strangers, and I got reviews and everything. And as fearless as it seems, it was actually the most normal feeling in the world, because for the first time, you know, I felt normal. Because for the first time, other people could relate to what I'd been through. I wasn't just this, you know, girl's stomach explodes, goes years without food or drink. And I think that was like a huge revelation for me, because it showed me that, you know, the healing power of stories, that like we heal when we just tell our story. It's that simple. Because I wasn't really able to move through, like, into feeling like a person until I could tell what happened to me, and more than that, like, have people empathize. So again, like, that kind of inspired me to take what was once just like a little musical and turn it into a whole kind of mental health and sexual assault prevention program. I got really fascinated by PTSD and trauma and understanding what it does to an individual. You know, it also made me feel not crazy when I realized all the psychological aftermath. And now I'm touring the show, not only as a musical, but, you know, I'm taking it to colleges and organizations, and just really, really excited to see that what I did kind of instinctively to heal is really legit stuff. Like, you know, we heal through creativity, through expressing, through sharing. And I mean, that's kind of my motto right now. You know, my whole Love My Detour hashtag. It's all about, you know, we love what happens to us, but also we gain strength in being able to love what happens to us by knowing we're not alone and knowing that, you know, there are other people going through detours. I always say that, you know, even though what I've been through is really extreme, it's not about kind of comparing war stories. It's all this is was a detour in my life. As big or as small as anyone else's unexpected glitch. Because what's important is how I coped and how I got through. You know, those are really basic skills that everyone has. You know, I cope through creating hope. I cope through just creativity and sharing stories. I cope through gratitude. So that's what I really like to talk about. Not just that I have an inspiring, crazy story, but I really hope that it's impactful. That, you know, I was just a teenager trying to figure it out as it went along, and it just happened that it turned me into a stronger person. And I just hope that my story kind of inspires other people to view adversity in that way. Sorry, yeah, that's a lot.
No, it's good. I mean, how do you feel about a media that sort of talks about disability and sort of differences of suffering, or a movie industry that comes out with movies that sort of people talk about where they don't sort of accept it and take it as a detour, it becomes a roadblock or the end of the road. How does that make
sense? It's interesting. Yeah. You know, it's very interesting because actually I was just presenting at the Mental Health America conference, and the theme this year was messages and media. And I personally, you know, I love that the mental health movement is getting so big and so strong right now. But what I hope the emphasis is on, it's not I'm going through this. You know, I hope it doesn't get very, like, you know, niche-y, that it's wonderful to stand up for what you've been through, but, and this is not to minimize what everyone's going through, but I think it's really by drawing the commonalities, and it's not to minimize it, it's saying, you know, listen, you know, I go into rooms and I present about this detour idea, and I see the room just melt. Because suddenly it's not about whether you're coping with a divorce or cancer, you lost your job, or, you know, PTSD. It's, you know, there's like a confidence that comes with that we're all going through things. So I want the mental health movement to be more kind of focus on compassion and openness rather than like kind of the uniqueness of everyone's struggle, because that uniqueness will always be there. But I think you really discover your uniqueness when it's coming from like a place of compassion and knowing that there are other people fighting along with you. In terms of like how the media views like disability and, you know, adversity as a roadblock, I see that in some places. Some places I don't, though. I mean, I was just thinking of a great music video, actually, Renegade by Ex Ambassadors, where, you know, it chronicles people's journeys. You know, one guy is blind that does this amazing rock climbing. That's just one example. But I think it's really in our kind of, you know, how we choose to perceive it. I always look at the power back in our hands. Because stuff is always going to be there, and there are always going to be people that don't understand. And that's the nature of, you know, someone who hasn't been through what you have. So I think it's our job not to, you know, let that hold us back, saying, you know, oh, they don't understand, but just to come at the world with even more compassion. I really feel like, you know, just like in making relationships, you win people over and people support your cause when you come from a place of positivity and not kind of the, you know, I'm the victim, you don't understand, at least from my own experience.
I mean, do you think, though, that it can be harmful that of a media that sort of tells people with disabilities, whether it's physical or that they're different or they're worse, could mean that there's something that it's not worth living? Because it seems like in some ways people are feeling like the upset is that it's not that you don't have, I mean, for some people it's that's the first option for people with disabilities, or it's something where it's like my life's over, and it seems like you've had to deal with that. And how is there
exactly
a compassionate way to sort of deal with this?
Right.
Way?
No, I completely agree with you that, you know, the media does do that. But the unfortunate thing is that, you know, there are always, if it's not the media, it's going to be someone who's ignorant. You know, what I learned is you will always get people that judge you, that limit you. But, you know, I think, you know, I'm speaking from my own experience that, listen, first I had doctors telling me I was definitely going to die. Then I had them say I was definitely never going to eat again. Then they said once I could eat, I'd probably only be able to have like a few hundred calories a day, and I'd always have to be on IV fluids. Then I had them say, you know, I'd never be able to walk again. Then it was I'd definitely never be able to dance again. You know, so, and this is just the beginning of the list. So many no's and nevers that, you know, I just happen to be a really stubborn person. So I just said, you know, bull, I'm not going to listen to that. But, you know, against their beliefs. And, you know, I don't blame them, because I was one of the sickest kids in the Columbia ICU, but I got everything back. So, you know, that's also why I share my story, too, because, listen, I don't blame any patient in the hospital that's hearing, you know, these doctors tell them you can't do this, you'll never be able to do this, and just accept it, because they're doctors and you trust them. You know, again, I'm just kind of really stubborn. I thought it was a good thing. But thank God I was, because I proved them wrong, and I'm really happy about that.
But the thing is, I think that people are upset about is it's not these specific instances. It's that society overall says somebody in a wheelchair is not supposed to be able to do this, or somebody with autism is not supposed to be able to do this, and it becomes
right.
A sort of social sort of thing. I think the individual instances are more personal. I think people are more talking
right.
about a cultural institutional level where it would be unfathomable as sexism or racism.
Right, right.
Or
no, I get that. I totally get that. And, you know, I say the same thing, that hopefully by, you know, raising our voices, you know, and positive movements, I think we're making some headway. But I think we can really prove our point by just coming from, you know, a place of positive. For me, it's like, you know what? I'm going to prove them wrong. And that's not even like a vengeful thing. That's like, you know what, I'm not living for, you know, for society. I, you know, I think, you know, that's so sad that society doesn't understand that. You know, let me kind of excel the best way I can, and then I'll show them that, you know, that's wrong. But I think, you know, advocating for disability rights, you know, all the, even the movements I see on social media, you know, the best thing we can do, you know, is education, because obviously if people really understood what a disability was, they wouldn't kind of be making these blanket statements.
Yeah, yeah, I see where you're coming from. I think you have some good points. Also, I mean, how do you feel about that with the sort of, and I get that it's not all the time, I'm not necessarily, but having more actors and people behind the scenes in the media, somebody who has been able to sort of break through in that way, in a way that many other people are not, whether it's disability or other ways, how do you sort of feel about the authenticity of having actors or writers or producers as somebody being able to break through and tell these stories like you've been able to?
Yeah, you know, obviously, you know, that's so important. And, you know, it's not the easiest for me. You know, I just wrote an article that was really popular about what it's like, you know, walking around with an open wound. You know, everywhere I go, I have to have this emergency bag. You know, I can't sit down, I can't twist, you know. And, you know, things like, you know, I used to do yoga all the time at the studio, but because I had an open wound, obviously I got kicked out. And, you know, it made me feel really hurt because it wasn't like me personally. But, you know, I understood that, you know, they're a studio, and I made adjustments. I started taking private. So that's one example of kind of when, you know, you have to make adjustments for you. But, yeah, in terms of, you know, writers and actors, I mean, the best thing we can do is just, you know, show who we are, you know, aside of, like, what our circumstances are. I think that's how I kind of broke in. You know, I focused on, okay, like, besides, you know, my limitations, like, what story do I have to tell? And I think we all, like, with disabilities, have a gift, you know, because we've been through something. Everything we're doing has some kind of, you know, deeper lens or something. So I think if we come across with that, I think people gravitate towards that. And that's not just like an idealist statement. I see that that's, you know, that's really worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that you're, you listen, you know, I'm all over the place now, but for 10 years, I wasn't doing anything. And looking back, I see it's because, you know, nothing really changed, but I kind of let society make me feel bad about myself. You know, those were the days where I would kind of spend hours scrolling on my Facebook newsfeed and looking at all my friends. And you know, you could just tell that, like, you know, I was, like, wearing it, like, you know, on my face. And, you know, my body language and all of that. So, I mean, again, like, I don't think this is kind of an idyllic statement for me to say, because I was discriminated against for a really long time until I started kind of not caring. And not coming at it from, you know, everyone's kind of discriminating against me. But you know what? Like, they would be lucky to have me. I have a story they need to hear. And I think that's what really got people's attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. No, I think that's a really good point. I mean, do you think some of that, though, how do you feel? I mean, because I think sometimes people feel, and it's on the opposite end, that you have to be incredible to even have a chance at somebody's disability. So, I mean, do you think there can be a middle ground where you can get in without having to sort of beat the odds?
Yeah, I'm not even talking about talent or being incredible. I'm just talking about, you know, the feeling like you're confident that you love yourself. You know, you're confident that you're doing your passion. You know, you might not be the best. Listen, I'm not the best dancer I used to be. You know, when I was in a coma, the doctors left me on my right side for 6 months. And so I got terrible neuropathy on my right leg. So I still, like, kind of half limp when I don't wear, you know, aces. So, you know, I'm not the best dancer anymore. I can tell you a million things I suck at. But I think, you know, it's a confidence we can lack sometimes when society tells us that, you know, we're not good enough, you know, we should be doing this, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, getting, you know, being the best at a certain talent, that might not be something within our control, but I think it is in our control to hear what society says and allow it not to affect us, even if it's not easy. But, like, I really think, you know, one, you know, coming at it from a place of confidence, two, taking time to really educate people on what you know, disability is. And three, you know, advocating for rights. I think that's a really good combination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Tell us about PTSD. I mean, I think a lot of people think about it as just something that happens to military veterans. I mean, how do you sort of expand that definition?
Exactly. That was actually the first comment, you know, many of the comments that I would get when I wrote, you know, my very first essay out for Huffington Post. I called it PTSD, the illness I couldn't see. And not only were people saying, you know, wow, I thought it only happened to military veterans, a lot of people were saying, wow, I think that explains, you know, what I was going through. I still can't get over that. Like, many survivors of sexual assault, like, never realized that they can suffer from PTSD. I certainly did. And it's not, you know, the thing about that is, it's not about, oh, okay, I have a label, I'm validated. It's once I realized what it was, you know, it really alleviated some of the guilt that I had that obviously I didn't deserve. But it also gave me an empowered approach where I could figure out what I could do about those things. In my essay, and I can give you this link if you want to share with your viewers, but I talk about the main symptoms that really kind of affected me. You know, PTSD is, you know, a trauma that's kind of out of the range of human experience. And certainly, you know, being sexually assaulted by a 60-year-old man when I was 17 was, and then, you know, complex trauma, you know, having my stomach explode, waking up and not eating and drinking for years, you have that combined. It's not a great combination. So the four symptoms I really kind of suffered from the most were, one, dissociation. That was my hugest thing, to the point where it definitely still affects me today, where, like, you know, obviously to cope with not eating and drinking, I had to become very numb. I didn't have a choice, because if I felt hunger, that was kind of a death sentence for me. So I got very good at kind of, you know, mentally leaving the situation and just numbing out. And so that was good as a survival skill. But the whole premise behind PTSD is, okay, those destructive coping mechanisms helped you at a traumatic time. However, they don't help you now. So healing from PTSD is really being able to inform your body, not even your mind, but your body, saying it's safe now. You don't need to use those coping mechanisms. And let me tell you something, it's really easy to inform your mind that. It is really hard to let your body know that. And that was where dissociation really affected me, where I could, like, understand PTSD beautifully, but I was so anxious as hell in my body, you know? So I realized that, unfortunately, I couldn't just talk the talk. I had to learn how to do mindfulness and meditation. I had to sit with myself. That was the hardest feeling in the world. The other three symptoms that I really suffered from were intrusive memories, you know, flashbacks. You know, I would get triggered by, I remember the first time I could eat again, I was so excited to have a French fry. It made me so anxious. And then I realized, once I did some reading on it, that that the French fry actually, you know, it was a good sensation. And that reminded me of other good sensations that my body felt when I was sexually assaulted that I didn't want it to feel good. And so that immediately caused an influx of guilt and all that. So putting those pieces together, I understood how the mind and body are connected in trauma in ways that you would never expect. So a little something about triggers. You know, I see, like, trigger warnings all over the place. Definitely triggers are warnings to ourselves. But if I had let trigger warnings kind of close me in and not do anything to overcome them, I would never have had any room for any joy in my life. I would sort of lived in a cage of trigger warnings. So it's kind of my message to people, too, that, listen, I had to work through some of the hardest feelings I had in my life. But thank God I did, because I realized until I did, I was just living in this gray kind of box of numbness, you know, afraid that anything would trigger me. And moving through those was so hard, and it still is hard, because I'll still get caught up in memories. But I realized, and I said this in my talk too, that, you know what, I'd rather feel everything than nothing at all, because I think when you're numb and you live life numb, not only is it not a great way to live, but it's scary. Because it's like you don't even know who you are. So, like, why are you here? You know? So basically, you're healing from trauma, and I can give you the link to this essay, too. It's a hard job, and I'm not done yet. You know, I think it happens in layers, but it's essential if you want to be more than just functional, and I think it's very worth it.
Mm-hmm. You think sometimes some of the things that you hear from people from disabilities is trauma that they've sustained based on social bias, that sort of things that we have to get over as well?
Yeah, this is a big deal. This is one of my missions, too. I think society is getting to understand this a little more. A lot of work has to be done. Trauma is a society issue. I can't tell you how many doctors made me feel bad once I was hooked up to eat that I couldn't move on with my life already. And I believed them until I realized, you know what, the doctors hooked up the physical parts of me, but I couldn't really feel once I started eating. So now all the emotional work was up to me. But I was appalled how little the world kind of understood. Like, and I realized that because I felt guilty, like up to actually pretty recently, that, oh my God, I'm taking so long to heal, I'll never get better. You know, from my family who had been through everything with me, from, you know, teachers that were smart. But I realized, you know, it's not their fault. It's not like an ignorant thing. It's just we don't do a good job of educating society that, you know, that, listen, people don't heal in a vacuum. In ancient Greece, here's something interesting. The ancient Greek plays, like Sophocles, those were actually meant for military veterans to come back into society by doing those plays. It was a way that the Greek society healed, you know, veterans by bringing them into society. We need more things like that. We need to make trauma a society issue. That's why I am touring my show because, you know, listen, there are a lot of kind of sexual assault programs, but I don't think, you know, just talking about bystander prevention and what's healthy consent, I don't think that does it. You know, I think people have to understand, listen, you know, the freeze response when you just are frozen in trauma, that can look a lot like consent too, but it's not. You know, I know that because I was 17 and I felt really guilty for a while asking myself, why didn't I do anything? And a lot of people ask me that too, and I believe them, you know, until I knew better when I did my research. So I can't emphasize enough that, yeah, people need to understand what PTSD is.
Well, I mean, is there anything else you'd like to share with our... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, no. I was just going to say, because, you know, survivors can only do part of the healing. And again, I learned that, you know, through my own experience. And I definitely would not have ever felt functional if I didn't feel accepted by society. So it's society's job to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Yeah, you know, I love hearing your stories. And like I said, I think we all heal through stories. Every Wednesday, I have like a Why Not Wednesday where I feature what I call a detourist. And they write about what a detour in their life is. And maybe, you know, how it made them who they are today. It doesn't have to be deep. It doesn't have to be a big deal if you don't want it to. But I think it really encourages people that we all go through kind of things. Or if you just want to, like, throw up a hashtag on social media, I love my detour, hashtag, maybe even a picture with a sign. I'm collecting those, too. But also, you know, my one-woman show, I'm touring it to, you know, support groups, hospitals, schools, anything like that. And I book myself. So if you want me to come to you, totally send me a note. I guess I'll give you my website and all that. And subscribe, because I got a book coming out at the end of next year. And I have three extras now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of them. I can write a story about my detour. We can do a picture for you. We could also put up some of the other people's on Wednesdays. If you send them to us, that we could put up some of those and direct them back to you as well.
Awesome.
So if we want to do a series through that, through you, and we would put it through you, that we could work that out.
Yeah, just send me a note. That would be awesome.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. Bye.